Welcome to Voice of Albion with Paul Hickman on the White Network.
April 1999. London in the UK was the centre of an unprecedented terror attack.
I put my hand out and it was like full of blood. And then I put my hand on my head and there was like something sticking out of my head.
The blast just caught me.
A lone right-wing fanatic went on a one-man rampage, killing three people and injuring hundreds.
I feel nothing. I did what I had to do.
Area within a minute just turned like a war zone.
He left a trail of destruction through the capital lasting 2 weeks, making this a crime that shook Britain. Saturday the 17th of April, Brixton Market, South London, was packed with weekend shoppers and traders.
I was at Brixton Market because my friends had to go to work up there and I went with them to spend the day.
As Miles McLeod helped his friend on the market stall, Paul Maskell was managing his staff and customers in a supermarket just yards away.
I was just like the day-to-day managing of the store, doing staff rotas, just normal everyday managing of a retail unit. It was coming to the end of the day, it was all looking forward to going home.
As Paul's day drew to a close, Miles and his friend waited for some extra trade.
Everyone else started packing up kind of early because some people didn't have a good day, but we was going to stay a little bit longer because we didn't have to be anywhere till early evening.
The bustling market was still heaving with people when Miles noticed something suspicious.
I walked down to go to the shop and then on the way back I noticed the bag and I let my friend know and my friend come over and started walking around the bag asking people if it was their bag and they said no. So my friend goes to me, pick it up.
Miles went to investigate, unaware the contents of the bag would change his life forever.
So I picked it up and then we walked around to Electric Avenue and we opened the bag and that's when we noticed it was a bomb. I had to actually look twice because you could actually see the nails, the Tupperware box, the batteries, the wires, and then you knew it was an explosive device.
Brixton was still packed full of shoppers, all unaware of what Miles and his friend had discovered.
I took it seriously straight away because I've never seen anything like that before. As soon as I've noticed and I've told my friends to get away and we started to stop people trying to get people away from it.
As Miles attempted to alert people of the danger, others were not so wary of the device in front of them.
Some people heeded the warnings, others didn't. One man in particular went up to the bag, it was a nice bag, a head bag, and took the device out of the bag and walked off with the bag.
The little gentleman what was on the fruit stall picked the bomb up from there and put it next to the green bin next to Iceland. At this time, they thought it was a joke still. They thought it wasn't real. It got moved three times. Me moving the bomb getting taken out of the bag and then the bomb getting put next to Iceland.
The makeshift bomb, packed with nails and stuffed into a plastic box, had been sat at Brixton Market for over 30 minutes.
A security guard come in and told me he felt someone had left a bomb outside. I couldn't really take that serious and just carried on the phone call really and ignored him. I could see that he was getting quite agitated about the events that were going on outside. He come in and told me and more or less insisted that I go outside now and have a look to see what was going on out there. And went outside and there was a crowd of people gathering around. We wasn't sure what a bomb would look like. We felt it would be like a big alarm clock with orange sticks underneath it. But this one turned out to be in a shoebox with a Tupperware box on top of it.
Paul, along with the crowd now gathering, wasn't convinced the device was real.
The guy was pointing out to me that there was like nails in the top and he could see wires, and he was convinced that was a bomb and we should do something about it. So I thought the first thing I should do is go and phone the police while the security guard was trying to keep people back. Not too many people at that time were taking much notice of him, and he was doing as best as he could trying to keep people back.
I've seen police across the road, so I've run across the road. I've told them there's an explosive over there, there's a bomb over there. And he got his notepad out and goes, what's your name and address?
I went inside the store, phoned the police. They told me I should evacuate the store and keep people away. Yet again, I couldn't really believe it was a bomb, so I took no notice of the police and didn't evacuate the place, and went outside saying, this just can't be a bomb. And we got within a few feet of it, and then it went off.
A terrifying explosion has devastated the heart of Brixton in London.
An explosion in South London has injured dozens of people. The blast in Brixton is being treated as a major incident.
A holdall containing more than 1,000 nails and deadly explosives had been planted near the crowded market. The Metropolitan Police had been given no warning and no motive. They were dealing with a ruthless terrorist whose intention was to kill and maim. As police searched for further clues to the tragedy, 5 miles across the city on Brick Lane, Dr. Hack and her family were heading home.
We are coming, returning to our North London home. As we are passing near the Brick Lane, suddenly we decided that to do some little shopping and to buy some Bengali newspaper. At that time, I was stopped by one of my patients, and we are chatting. We parked our car on the Brick Lane, and just before 6, as we are just about to return, so we are about to just cross the road. My husband was on the other side. Whole area was really in dark cloud that you could not see what is happening, and my whole body was covered with the glass splinters. All the windows were broken, smashed, and you didn't know what is happening.
We had the ground floor had just been completely devastated. The whole front of the actual shop, or that's what I thought it was at the time, had been blown out. There was glass everywhere. You couldn't tell that it was a pub at all, really. Most of the chairs and tables had been literally blown apart. There was still a small fire at the back of the property. Inside, there were people lying about moaning, some with partial amputation limbs. Quite a few people with severe burns, and there was an awful lot of nails. We're talking 6-inch nails, so you could see them protruding out of people's arms, legs, faces, chest.
Now, a party election broadcast by the British National Party.
Here at the Cenotaph, every year, we remember those millions of men and women who gave their lives so that Britain might remain free. Yet right now, the politicians are planning to destroy this freedom. Liver and the Liberal Democrats and the so-called nationalists in Scotland and Wales support a European single currency, which is just a step towards a European superstate and the end of Britain's freedom. The Tories say not at the moment, but they don't rule it out later. In other words, they're completely irresolute about preserving the freedom that our ancestors died for. We believe our war dead deserve something better. We believe we owe it to them to preserve Britain as a free nation, which means not only opposing a single currency and a federal Europe, but bringing this country out of Europe altogether.
In 1973, Tory Prime Minister Heath signed the Treaty of Rome and dragged us into Europe. It's now time to take stock. We were told about the economic benefits, but what are the facts? Well, we now have an adverse balance of trade with the European Union of £6.2 billion every year. British industry has been gutted as European exporters have invaded our markets. Our fishermen have been ruined, and thousands of British farmers have been put out of business. Some people in this election are saying, yes, let's get out of Europe and have free trade with the world. But where has that got us? Many imports aren't from Europe, but they still destroy British jobs. We need to rebuild our economy through a Buy British policy. We need to protect our manufacturers, our farmers, our fishermen, and other British workers. Recent opinion polls have found that 80% of the British people are against the single currency, and 40% want out of Europe altogether. People like these.
One of the things that concerns me is that we have to pay £20 a week extra per family for food in Europe. I think we should get out, so I'm voting BNP.
I just don't like someone in Europe telling me what to do. We're British. We should govern ourselves. I'm voting BNP.
Europe's been a complete disaster for most British farmers and industry. We'd be far better off out of it. That's why I support the BNP.
I'm not against Europeans. We can be friends with Europe, but let's stay British. We've got over 1,000 years of history. It would be madness to throw it away.
I'm voting BNP because I don't trust the Tories. One moment they're facing one way on Europe, the next moment another way. We've got to come out.
So can Britain get out of Europe? Can we go it alone?
Yes, we can. This is not a second-rate nation. Across the ages, this nation has stood alone and survived and come through. Again and again, the British people have taken their destiny into their own hands and by their own fighting spirit amazed the world. What an insult to our ancestors, who gave their lives for our freedom, to say that after all their sacrifice, we must now cave in. Surrender without a fight, because our rulers have lost the will to govern. In this election, you have this unique chance to vote against this betrayal, to vote against Britain in Europe, and for the recovery of British freedom, by voting British National Party.
That was a party election broadcast by the British National Party.
Welcome to Voice of Albion on the White Network, John Tyndall, Part 16. You may recall that last week we started with an intro of the 1998 BNP Annual Conference. John Tyndall was still the leader of the party at that time. Nick Griffin had joined the party in 1995 and was welcomed by John Tyndall. In April 1999, David Copeland, who had been a BNP member for a short time, for about a year, embarked on an album campaign which lasted 13 days. In the 3 separate bomb attacks, he targeted blacks, Bangladeshis, and finally, a gay pub. David Copeland succeeded in killing 3 white people, including 1 pregnant woman. He received 6 life sentences and was ordered to serve at least 50 years. He currently resides at Broadmoor Mental Hospital. It was in this climate that the BNP stood in the Euro elections of 10th June 1999. This was the first time the BNP qualified for a TV broadcast which was viewed by millions of Britons for a Euro campaign. The party stood in every region of England and Scotland. The vote turned out to be fairly poor. I would have thought the media had made much capital out of David Copeland and his bombing spree, and that affected the vote. In September of 1999, Nick Griffin beat John Tyndall in the leadership challenge for the British National Party leadership. Griffin won 62% of the vote. Griffin won on a modernising ticket. It's doubtful the members who voted for Griffin realised just how far this modernisation of party ideology and direction would go. Considering Nick Griffin's hardcore past and his rightly denying the Holocaust in 1997, no one could be blamed for not foreseeing these changes which were to come. John Tyndall challenged Griffin by 2001 and strongly disagreed with Griffin's decisions once becoming leader. This we'll look more into next week. There was a demo by the social nationalist youth group National Action in Coventry the other week. It was a demo against Muslim halal slaughter. I'll post a link on the show page as I took part in it. National Action will be doing a banner drop for the White Man March on 15th of March. If you are a youth who would like to get involved in street activism, Google National Action. If you'd like to get involved with a white social nationalist party, then get in touch with the National Front at britishnationalfront.net. Membership is just £15. Now the 11th Hour by John Tyndall. Chapter 18, Britain and the World. JT writes, among the many disastrous areas of British policy over the past century, none ranks higher as a cause of national decline than a handling of foreign affairs. As with the economy, it is doubtful indeed whether we can claim to have had a policy at all. JT quotes General Douglas MacArthur's axiom, there is no substitute for victory. Indeed, there is not, and that applies to the competition between nations, no less in peacetime than in wartime, he states. The trouble with British leaders over the past century is that not only have they made extravagant use of high-sounding moral verbiosity to sanctify their international actions, but they have actually come themselves to believe in their own words and fall victim to their own propaganda. What was in previous ages a coherent and rational tradition of foreign policy, conceived in accordance with sane strategic considerations, denigrated into a succession of disjointed reactions to events around the world, fueled much more by emotion than by rational judgment, and pursued in the service of pure abstractions, which seldom bore any relation whatever to national concerns. This does not mean that nowhere in recent policy have such national interests come into the equation. Some consideration for these has remained in the minds of those in charge of affairs. But such has been the atmosphere of hysterics in which great issues of foreign affairs have been debated, that, even when the national interest has been given some thought, the judgment of where it lay has usually turned out to be an appallingly bad one. An example of this has been the application of the principle of the balance of power, in quotes, in Europe. This was a perfectly sane principle for a number of centuries, where England and later Britain were concerned. The error lay in failing to recognise when that principle had become out of date, which it had by about the middle of the 19th century. When Britain was a comparatively small European nation, living on the edge of a continent, dominated by a much more populous and powerful Spain or France, it made much sense for us to align ourselves with whichever state or coalition of states represented at any one time the main counterweight to whichever of these powers was in the ascendancy. In this way, JT continues, the latter's power was curbed and the security of these islands was protected. Even in the early stages of the opening up of the New World, when Britain had acquired extensive colonies, the principle still held good. France was still a formidable rival in North America, and at the time a nation of considerably greater resources than ourselves. She was only prevented from bringing greater force to bear against us across the Atlantic by her heavy military commitments in Europe, such as the War of Spanish Succession, 1704-14, and the 7 Years' War, 1756-63, to which we ourselves added by signing with the anti-French coalitions in both cases, an entirely sane policy at the time. In the Napoleonic era, our participation in the anti-Bonapartist coalitions was again undertaken in accordance with the same principles of realpolitik. Every indication existed that the first Napoleon could, and would, have invaded us had we not chosen this road and assisted thereby in tying down his forces elsewhere in Europe. A generation previously, French intervention on the side of the rebel colonists in America had been largely instrumental in bringing about the British defeat. Had Napoleon succeeded in beating us in Europe, there is every likelihood that France would have sought to reverse her defeat at Quebec in 1759 and retake Canada. But by the middle, and certainly by the end of the 19th century, the international situation had entirely changed, rendering obsolete the strategic considerations that had been perfectly valid at the century's beginning and before. France was no longer the leading power in Europe, having been overtaken both by Britain and Germany. German potential was formidable, JT points out, but no more so than our own had we been prepared to organise properly the resources of our then immense empire. In contrast to France previously, Germany was no threat to us in any of our overseas dominions. Even with the increased naval power that she had started to develop under Wilhelm II. Late in the rush for colonies, she had obtained territory in East and South West Africa. But the fear that she might wish to add to this by conquering our own African possessions was, at the most, speculative. Quick note there, Wilhelm II was grandson of Queen Victoria. It seems she had carefully arranged the houses of Europe, including the German Hohenzollerns, to be united by blood bonds. Wilhelm had no intention of attacking or taking over any British colonies, just like Hitler 20 years later. In a biography of him called Wilhelm the Impetuous, the Last Kaiser, the author quotes Kaiser William as saying to Britain, "You police the seas and let Germany police the lands of Europe." Kaiser Wilhelm did send artillery and guns to the Afrikaners, who were being invaded by Britain 1899 to 1902. And he sent telegrams of congratulations in battles that the Boers won. It was the growing German navy above all, though, that concerned Britain, having as they did a 2-to-1 policy, whereby no other power could be allowed to have more than half the size of the Royal Navy. That is to say, Britain's navy must be at least twice as big as anyone else's, to retain maritime supremacy. Kaiser Wilhelm, incidentally, was concerned in the rise of China in the long term and referred to China as the Yellow Peril. That book you can get on Amazon, The Last Kaiser, is by Giles McDonough, or Donoghue, I'm not sure how you pronounce that Scottish name. It only gets 3 stars out of 5 on Amazon, and it is quite critical of Kaiser Wilhelm, but pretty good book, I thought. JT continues, "It was true that she maintained the best army in Europe, Germany that is, but the briefest look at European geography and history should have sufficed to explain why. Confronted by a reactionist-minded and rapidly arming France on one side, and a fast industrializing Russia on the other, she had every reason to feel the need for powerful land forces, while her growing navy was no more than necessary to safeguard her trading routes and her access to her colonies. That Germany might covert British possessions in Africa was not inconceivable, but it was certainly not probable. With potential enemies enough, it was hardly likely that she should wish to add to these what was then the greatest empire in the world. In this situation, Britain should not have been complacent about German power, but most certainly should not have regarded it as the greatest threat to her interests. No nation can arm against everybody at once, and at every stage of international affairs, there has to be a careful and balanced calculation as to what kind of foreseen danger is the most probable and immediate. It is JT's view that, had there been such calculation in Britain in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, prudent policy would have pointed to a different attitude towards Germany than the one which, in the outcome, was adopted. He He states the strength of Germany had come primarily through sound internal development. There had been a steady growth of population, which had accelerated particularly rapidly since unification in 1871. That unification had mobilized into one single force the previously scattered and often warring German states, excluding Austria. With this unified Reich, that's the Second Reich, I believe, there had been a spectacular development of manufacturing industry, utilizing the advantages of Bismarck's Zollverein to achieve a large and expanding internal market. Some notes on the Zollverein. Encyclopedia Britannica says, in 1834, the Zollverein, or Customs Union, including most of the states of the German Confederation, came into existence. With the accession of several more states by 1842, only Austria and the northwest coastland remained aloof. The industrialists of the Habsburg Empire, that's the Austrian Empire, which later became the Austro-Hungarian Empire, wanted their products protected against outside competition, felt that the tariffs of the new association were too low for their needs, whereas the merchants and bankers of the coastal region, who depended on foreign trade, thought they were too high. Yet for some 25 million Germans, the Zollverein meant, in effect, the achievement of commercial unification without the aid of political unification. So, basically, the Zollverein was an economic union involving tariffs implemented in 1834, which contributed to the political union of Germany later in 1871. Bismarck's political career seems to have started in 1847, when he joined the conservative Gerlach group and attended the Prussian Diet, that's the parliament. It ended when he resigned as Chancellor of Germany in 1890 at Kaiser Wilhelm's insistence. So Bismarck couldn't have invented the Zollverein because he wasn't in politics, but he took it up and then obviously strengthened it and incorporated it into the political unification in 1871. JT continues, finally, the Germans, under the impress of Prussian leadership, were a highly orderly and disciplined nation, practicing a level of civic virtues probably higher than were to be found in any of the larger states in the Western world. Britain's best assurance against eclipse by this new Germany always lay in precisely the same form of internal development by which the latter nation had grown powerful. Therefore, the absolute top priority of British policy should have been to organise and develop the enormous resources of our empire in a similar process of industrial expansion resting primarily on a national rather than international market. Imperial Federation, as mentioned in a previous chapter, should have been pursued in the same way as had the German Federation, and it should not have been reluctant to emulate some of the Prussian virtues of citizenship, bearing in mind that these had been developed in a race much more closely related to ourselves in character and treatment, character and temperament, than any other on the continent. Finally, JT adds, Britain should, as part of the same process, have adopted universal military service and training, bringing the armies of her empire up to the same strength and standards of efficiency as the German. From this position, JT contends, Britain could have made herself virtually invulnerable to attack by Germany, even in the extremely unlikely event of the latter country entertaining hostile designs against her or any part of her empire. For the price of such an attack to the Germans would have been far too high. Parallel with this, we should have sought to renew the ancient tradition of Anglo-German alliance, rather than opt for the disastrous Entente Cordiale, which in the event drove Europe eventually to war and self-destruction. Racial affinity apart, this policy should have been based on the simple calculation that, of all the major powers in Europe, Germany was placed in a situation which made her our least likely enemy. But Britain did none of these things, JT points out. She remained weak internally by her unwillingness to adopt the political measures required for the consolidation and coordination of her empire. She likewise did not adopt the necessary practices for the proper coordination of her economy. Finally, by libertarian code of citizenship among her people, she encouraged the spirit of individualistic greed and selfishness instead of a firm sense of community, or Volk. As for military power, the best comment on this at the time was made by Otto von Bismarck when he said, "If the British land an army on the coast of Germany, I shall send a policeman to arrest it." Being internally weak behind all the days of her imperial panoply, Britain could see no better guarantee of her own security than to put her support behind whatever strength could be mobilised on the continent against Germany. By joining the Entente Cordiale, she simply encouraged the French towards more aggressive posturing and thus heightened the tension in Europe to a point which inevitably had its effect in Germany, bringing about an escalation of mutual suspicion which eventually exploded in 1914. Indeed, as far back as the end of the Franco-German War, the British outlook of international events had begun to be influenced by attitudes in which emotion was rapidly overtaking common sense as the main directing force. Typical was a speech made by the House of Commons in February 1871 by Mr. Oberon Herbert, the source of which is from Dr. Pete Peel in his book British Public Opinion and the Wars of German Unification, 1864-71, said the speaker to the House. "I must say that I look on the unification of Germany as a great peril to Europe, and for this reason no one will deny that the unification of Germany began with an essentially democratic movement. Since 1830, 15 sovereign princes have been removed from their thrones by their respective peoples. We have at this moment the unification of Germany under military despotism. It cannot be for the good of Europe that there should be a great military despotism in Germany, built upon the ruin and destruction of France." J.T. comments, "Here we see two themes typical of the silliness of the doctrinaire liberal moraliser. There is the implication that an authoritarian government standing at the head of a strong and efficient army is more likely to be a threat to the peace than a democratic one," in quotes, a notion for which there is not a shred of historical evidence. Along with this, there is the assertion that the ruling regime in Germany was built upon the ruin and destruction of France. This conveniently ignores the truth that it was French blustering and provocation that are at least as much a factor in bringing the war of 1870-71 about as any actions by the Germans. Indeed, probably more so. That the Germans chose the moment of the French defeat to unite their former separate states into a single empire was purely incidental. That unification would have come about sooner or later in any event, and almost certainly under the leadership of the House of Hohenzollern. By the end of the 19th century, this strictly ideological view of international and political affairs had come to be the dominating feature in the British conduct of foreign relations, and under these conditions, anything resembling the proper foreign policy disappeared. On the Versailles Treaty that followed, World War I, J.T. quotes Marshal Foch, who at the time said, "This is not peace, it is merely a ceasefire for 20 years. Britain, having learned nothing from the recent past, was back again playing the old game of the balance of power. The object was, of course, no more to deny Germany her natural place as the leading nation on the European mainland, and to that end weaken her as much as possible by means of reparations, the seizure of parts of her territory and people, the prohibition of her manufacture of certain vital weapons of self-defence, and the confinement of the size of her army to 100 thousand men. A quite ridiculous condition in view of Germany's situation vis-à-vis her neighbours. A simpleton ought to have seen that none of this could ever work, and that in the course of time the German national spirit would inevitably assert itself once again, and all these absurd fetters would cast away like gnats from the wings of an awakened eagle. But such obvious facts did not impress themselves on the minds of the figures who presided over Britain's destinies in the 1920s and 1930s. As quickly as, with one hand, we were making ourselves a party to the imposition of peace terms that curtailed all the seeds of future war. With the other, we were denuding ourselves of all the vital resources that had enabled us to be victorious in the previous one. JT then quotes from The Mighty Continent by John Terrain. Year by year, relying on collective security through the League of Nations with general popular approval, British governments dismantled British power. In 1919, the Royal Navy had regained a supremacy unequalled since the Napoleonic Wars. In 1922, at the fatal Washington Conference, Britain accepted battleship parity with the United States. She agreed to scrap all the battleships, stop current building, and build no more battleships for 10 years. So the Navy, once the nation's pride, was allowed to slide into numerical weakness and technical obsolescence. The Royal Air Force similarly, in 1919, the RAF was the most powerful in the world, with 22,000 operational aircraft. By 1922, it had sunk to one-tenth the size of the French Air Force. As for the Army, it was not to be compared with the efficient and well-equipped Expeditionary Force of 1914. But no one seemed to mind, except the Chiefs of Staff, whose noses were increasingly rubbed into the consequences. Ramsay MacDonald expressed a widespread belief when he told the Fifth Assembly of the League of Nations, "Our interests for peace are far greater than our interests in creating the machinery of defence. The machinery of defence is easy to create, but beware lest in creating it you destroy the chance for peace." At the same time this was happening in Britain, JT states, was throwing away all the gains she had made on the industrial front under the stimulus of war. He quotes John Terrain again. Britain had inevitably suffered by the loss of shipping and overseas markets through the war. At the same time, however, she had profited by a long overdue industrial revival, an important step towards the Second Industrial Revolution. New industries had been created by the war and were here to stay. Chemicals, aircraft and aero engines, the refining of non-ferrous metals, electrical generating capacity had doubled, electric ball production had quadrupled, ball bearing production had doubled, optical glass production had increased 60 times. All these were valuable gains, and with them had gone a great modernisation and reorganisation of existing industries with large measures of state control. The question was whether these gains would be maintained and carried forward in peace. The answer, soon given, was that they would not. Orthodox economic theory, belief in free trade and laissez-faire, dislike of state control, lack of enterprise among industrialists, all these helped to account for a sense of poverty which was not entirely justified by fact, but justified or not, its consequences were far-reaching. JT continues, Britain was, in other words, doing exactly what she had been doing in the years preceding the World War. While her handling of foreign affairs was such as to make war increasingly likely, she was allowing herself to be weakened militarily and industrially so as to render her least ready to wage war effectively when it came. In 1933, Hitler came to power in Germany and immediately began, as it was always predictable that someone would, redressing the grievances arising out of Versailles. Claims were made upon lands and peoples that had been forcibly separated from Germany. While armed forces were built up to a level necessary to give backing to these claims. At the same time, a revolution took place in Germany, giving rise to an extraordinary new surge of energy, dynamism and reconstruction. JT asserts, our attitude should have been based, as it should in all such considerations of foreign affairs, on a cool assessment of what was in the British interest, and our policy should have been formulated in accordance with that assessment. Hitler's plans were to lead, as was obvious, to Germany once again reasserting her natural position as the strongest power in continental Europe. The whole point of the matter was, would Britain be threatened by this development? And from this a further question arose. Even if it was perceived that Germany might represent some threat to us, Could that threat be removed except by bringing into balance forces that would compromise a much greater and more likely threat? This latter question was the crucial one, JT contends. No nation, least of all one with the World War commitments that Britain had at the time, can hope to ever enjoy a condition of total security. Why statecraft, as hinted before, involves the careful weighing up of the various available security options, and deciding on the one that offers the greatest probability of security in relation to the cost of achieving it. If Britain was uneasy about the sceptre of a powerful Germany bestriding Europe like a colossus, what options had she? In fact, there were only two. One was to call into being a war to destroy Germany, which in view of Britain's own weakness at the time, could only be won with the help of stronger allies, which, as a price of such a victory, would dictate the peace that followed, and would most probably present a much greater threat to our security and interests than Germany was ever likely to do. This was the reality that stared British leaders in the face in the 1930s. To be specific, they should have realised that the new Germany could not be beaten except with the help of Russia or America, or both, and that this help would have to be paid by way of the domination of the world by either or both of these powers in the peace that would follow. The one alternative to this was to accept German power in Europe and learn to live with it, but, as the firmest possible guarantee against the use of that power against ourselves, to dedicate our energies to building up the strength of Britain and her empire to such a peak that no power in the world could attack us except as a cost which would render the whole enterprise counterproductive. This would have meant, firstly, the organisation of empire into a single unit, along the lines mentioned earlier, which would have presented Germany, even had she considered attacking us, with an adversary which in white population alone was close to being equal to her in numbers, and in which natural resources was considerably superior. Secondly, the carrying out of an industrial revolution that would have brought British manufacturing output to that level, if not in excess of German output. Thirdly, the mobilisation by means of all the resources of empire, of a military power equal to that of Germany. Finally, the carrying out of a political and social revolution within Britain and her empire that would achieve the same high degree of organisation, efficiency, orderliness and national discipline as had been achieved by Germany herself. Not necessarily with methods identical to those used in the latter country, but at least with a view to the same effect. All this, of course, would have been a gigantic undertaking, but no more so than World War II was to prove to be, and whereas the latter impoverished and ruined the old Britain, the former would have made Britain stronger and more prosperous than at any previous time in her history. No greater effort would have been required in one than in the other, JT argues, and the result in the first case would have been positive rather than negative. Its effects would have been to build rather than to destroy. This, of course, would have meant an entire reorientation of Britain's energies and preoccupations. Instead of foreign adventures conceived with a view to meddling in everyone else's affairs, we would have turned our attention to the priority of internal development and got on with the long-neglected tasks of putting our house in order. One prominent public figure, and one alone, advocated this policy in the 1930s. JT makes no apologies for again quoting Sir Oswald Mosley, speaking in October 1938, as the war clouds were gathering. He said, "Supposing two lots of Englishmen wanted to join up and get together, what would you think of Germany if she said, 'No, you can't. If you two lot of Englishmen get together, we will declare war on you.' We would tell Germany, or any other country that said two lots of Englishmen can't get together, to go to hell. And you know it. Supposing that Kent was occupied by the Portuguese, and that in Kent the Portuguese were insulting the British flag and bullying British womanhood, we in Britain would not stand for it. We would say those British people are coming home to Britain. What would we say to Germany if she tried to stop us? Yet that is what the Labour Party want to do to the Germans. Each great nation has to awake in its own great way. We, the British people, will never copy any other nation on earth, because we believe that with our own people, we can make this the greatest nation in the world, and that the whole world will look to Britain for an example. I want one day to be able to say to Hitler, I don't care what you do in the east of Europe, good luck to you. We are going to beat you in the race for higher wages. We are going to beat you in the race to build the fairest, noblest land the world has ever seen. JT Commons. There will, of course, be those who will say to this that Britain could not stand by idly when atrocities were being committed by the Germans, both in their own country and in the lands they occupied. But to this claim, Moseley made his reply in the columns of Action newspaper in December 1938, in which he said, supposing every allegation were true, supposing it was a fact that a minority in Germany were being treated as the papers allege, was that any reason for millions of Britons to lose their lives in a war with Germany? How many minorities in how many countries have been treated since the war, have been ill-treated since the war without any protest from press or politicians? Why was it only when the Jews were the people affected that we had any demand for war with the country concerned? There was only one answer, that today Jewish finance controlled the press and political system in Britain. If you criticise a Jew at home, then jail threatens you. If others touch a Jew abroad, then war threatens them. Moseley spelt jail with the old way, apparently, which was G-A-O-L, J-L. I didn't know that was English, but that's the old way of writing jail, apparently. JT continues, Chamberlain's efforts notwithstanding, the war lobby won the day. Britain joined France in giving the ridiculous pledge to Poland that they would come to that country's aid in the event of a German invasion, a pledge that made the coming conflict inevitable. Apologists for the War Brigade will claim, of course, that much more was at stake in 1939 than the territorial integrity of Poland. Hitler, they will protest, had to be stopped. If he was not challenged at that point, he would have proceeded to further conquests until he had the whole of Europe under his heel. Those who believe this claptrap have clearly not made the slightest effort to inform themselves about, least of all understand, the objectives of Hitler's expansionist policy. It was clear from a reading of Mein Kampf that Hitler did not believe in multinational empires, as anyone will know who has bothered to study what he said about the Austro-Hungarian state in which he grew up. What Hitler did want was the incorporation of all ethnic Germans in a single state. Beyond that, he wanted new lands to accommodate Germany's surplus population, and in that regard favoured an expansion east and colonisation eastwards, in the manner that had been the custom of Germans since the Teutonic Knights. I believe it was the Teutonic Knights that had Prussia off Poland in exchange for Christianising the place. I believe so. JT states, the only valid reason for going to war to prevent Hitler's expansion in Eastern Europe would have been the belief that afterwards he would have turned west and threatened us. All the evidence points to him not having the slightest intention of doing any such thing. This would be further borne out in 1940 when, having pushed the British expeditionary force back to the Channel, he halted his armies to let it escape, largely intact, across the water. This revealing moment in history was described by Captain Basil Littlehart in The Other Side of the Hill. In chapter 10 of his book, in which the author chronicles the German invasion of France down to Dunkirk, he mentions Hitler's telegram to General von Kleist, instructing him to halt his forces at medium artillery range from Dunkirk, and then the German leader's subsequent conversation with Field Marshal von Rundstedt, in which he explained his decision. The author then quotes a report from one of those present at his conversation, thus, he, Hitler, then astonished us by speaking with admiration of the British Empire, at the necessity of its existence and of the civilization that Britain had brought to the world. He compared the British Empire with the Catholic Church, saying they were both essential elements of stability in the world. He said that all he wanted from Britain was that she should acknowledge Germany's position on the continent, The return of Germany's lost colonies would be desirable, but not essential, and he would even offer support to Britain with troops if she should be involved with any difficulties anywhere. He concluded by saying that his aim was to make peace with Britain on a basis that she would regard compatible with her honour to accept. Captain Little Heart added his own comment to this quotation. If the British army had been captured at Dunkirk, the British people might have felt that their honour had suffered a stain which they must wipe out. By letting it escape, Hitler hoped to conciliate them. JT writes, the absurdity of the view that Hitler had to be opposed for marching into Poland on the grounds of that nation's right to have the territorial integrity guaranteed was, of course, doubly underlined when the Soviets shortly afterwards occupied the eastern part of that same country. Needless to say, we did not then hear screams on that account that Britain should go to war with the Soviet Union. JT then talks about the Daily Express article of March 24, 1933, entitled Judea Declares War on Germany. He talks about the Jewish worldwide economic war waged against Germany and quotes Mr. Samuel Untermeyer of the USA, who was elected president of the World Jewish Economic Federation, who gave an address over station WABC, the text of which was printed in the New York Times, August 7, 1933. It quoted Mr. Untermeyer as saying, each of you, Jew and Gentile alike, who is not already enlisted in this sacred war against Hitler's Germany, should do so now and here. These sentiments were echoed by Vladimir Jabotinsky, writing in a Jewish publication, Nachricht, in January 1934. The fight against Germany has been carried out for months by every Jewish community, conference, trade organisation, by every Jew in the world. We shall let loose a spiritual and a material war of the whole world against Germany. JT then talks about the Venlo incident described in the Schellenberg memoirs, written by Walter Schellenberg, a high-ranking official of the security forces of the SS. Schellenberg describes how he met in Holland two British intelligence agents while posing himself as a representative of an anti-Hitler faction in Germany at the very early stages of the war. JT assumes one of the purposes for this operation was to ascertain what kind of approaches were being made by the British to this faction. In his book, Schellenberg describes the terms carried by the British agents on behalf of their government, which will be offered to Germany in the event of Germany's overthrowing Hitler and agreeing to the ceasefire. Schellenberg, the political overthrow of Hitler and his closest assistants was to be followed immediately by the conclusion of the peace with the Western powers. The terms were to be the restoration of Austria, Czechoslovakia and Poland to their former status, the reunification of Germany's economic policies, the renunciation of Germany's economic policies, and a return to the gold standard. The possibility of return to Germany of the colonies she had held before the First World War was one of the most important subjects of our discussion. And JT comments, the key words in this passage are, of course, the renunciation of Germany's economic policies and a return to the gold standard. These words make it abundantly clear that there were other motives at work on the part of the powers arrayed against Germany, besides the stated ones that occupied the front of the stage of Allied war propaganda. Germany's economic policies and a rejection of the gold standard were measures that had long predated the war and the apparent causes of the war. The outcome of World War II vindicated all those who had predicted catastrophe for Britain in consequence of her involvement in it. Germany could only be beaten by a coalition of the British Empire, the United States and Soviet Russia, a measure of the titanic strength of the state Hitler had brought into being. JT then quotes Dr. Peter Peel, who in British Public Opinion and the Wars of German Unification, 1864-71, commented on the so-called special relationship after World War II. The economic and military dependence of Britain on the United States after World War II is a long and shameful record. It enabled the United States to put pressure on Britain to get out of India and to go far beyond the stipulations, even of the Balfour Declaration, to permit the setting up of a sovereign Jewish state on Arab lands in Palestine. It enabled the United States to dictate the withdrawal of the British forces from Suez in 1956 after their successful operation to recover the canal. Pathetically, the British talked for a while of their special relationship with the United States, even of partnership in quotes. They would not see that partnership is only possible between more or less equal in wealth and power. Between two parties more or less equal in wealth and power. The Britain stripped of its empire could only be a client kingdom. It could no more be a partner of the United States than Athens or perhaps Macedon could be a partner of Rome. Modern Britain, sheltering under the supposed willingness of the United States to undertake a nuclear war in defence of what Yalta has left of Europe, has sent each Prime Minister cap in hand to Washington since World War II. JT comments that Dr. Peel's reference to Yalta is pertinent, for it was at that conference in 1945 that the Americans colluded with Stalin to bring the Soviets to the Elbe, to give them that portion of Europe which for the next 4.5 decades was to lie behind the Iron Curtain, and thereby to split our continent in two. The American attitude, as pointed out by Peel, is obviously not unconnected with the vast population change that has taken place in the United States over the past 100 years, and the shifting of power away from the former Anglo-Saxon ascendancy. The tendency to indecent haste to please America could be seen as far back as 1921, when at the Washington Naval Conference, referred to earlier, Britain announced its intention, which it finally carried out 2 years later, to terminate the Anglo-Japanese alliance. The decision, JT states, was made largely to placate the United States, which was hostile to that alliance. It had a disastrous effect on Anglo-Japanese relations, the maintenance of which was of enormous importance to our Far Eastern interests. Writing of this action in From Admiral to Cabin Boy, Admiral Dovoyle said, "The Japanese have behaved loyally to the terms of the alliance, and although it would have been put to a severe test by the acquisitive nature of the Japanese foreign policy, we could have kept a restraining hand on this policy with far greater effect than has been possible since the termination of the treaty, and the consequent deterioration of our friendly relations. Our motives for abrogating the treaty were never fully understood or trusted, and suspicion increased with the passage of the years, which shoved our subservience to America policy to an ever-increasing event." Don Boyle continued, "A foreign policy that regrets strategical considerations is bound to come to grief in the long run, and we shall see that our foreign policy during the period under consideration resulted in the estrangement of these countries whose friendship was essential to our own security, and in their ultimate combination against us, whereby they achieved a collective security far in advance of any attained by its sponsors of Geneva. Our anxiety to curry favour with our rich relations across the Atlantic was costing us dear." JT writes, "The title of Admiral Dovoyle's book is interesting, for thereby hangs a story. In his choice of it, he is referring to the demotion in his national status that occurred when he was incarcerated in prison without trial during World War II for the crime of daring to oppose that war, predicting the awful results it would have for Britain. He was one of the numerous men of distinction in this country, Sir Oswald Mosley being another, who were not listened to in their analyses and prognostications. Instead, they were flung into vermin-infested jails and concentration camps by a government that was calling upon the British people to fight for democracy and freedom," in quotes. "Today we erect statues to those who were responsible for the ruinous British policy of those times, while these men are dismissed or forgotten, and their writings and speeches hardly ever allowed to see the light of day. whereby they might be evaluated by the present generation in the light of history. One day, JT predicts, this will change, and these prophets will be accorded the honour and respect that is their due. This orthodox reading of the post-1945 status quo, JT points out, was that the advanced nations of the world were now split into two mutually hostile camps, one led by Soviet Russia, with aggressive designs of world military conquest in order to institute world communism, and the other led by the United States, providing against this bloc a bulwark of democracy and freedom, in quotes. The assumption in all this was that Britain's place lay, naturally and alternably, in the latter camp, and that her interests and security lay in integrating her policies increasingly closely with those of America. If she and her neighbours in Europe did not do this, the argument ran, they would make themselves vulnerable to conquest and enslavement by the Russians. That reminds me a bit of the film Red Dawn. Is it Red Dawn where there's a communist invasion of America by air troops and stuff? JT contends that behind the facade of Western Soviet enmity, there was all along Western Soviet collaboration. A look at the whole pattern of world affairs since 1945 lends much support to such a view. During the alleged Cold War, America and Russia continued growling at each other on the international stage, and as part of this, sustained armaments programs at enormous expense, ostensibly in defense against each other. But where actually did the two come into conflict, JT asks. Contrary to the supposition of conflict, there were a number of areas of policy in which the US and the Soviet Union were in close accord. Both endorsed and assisted the dismantlement of the great European empires in accordance with the sentiments of President Roosevelt quoted earlier. Both were consistently promoting the breakdown of the barriers separating white and non-white races, and in particular the destruction of white South Africa. Both in the 1960s and 70s were in accord over the need to destroy white Rhodesia, and both worked tirelessly to that very end. In the economic field, their collaboration was constant. Time and time again, when the Soviets had a harvest failure, the Americans helped them out with food supplies on generous terms. EC butter and other surpluses time and time again were sold at knockdown prices to Russia with no American disapproval. And there was a constant flow of Western, particularly American, technology and money into Soviet industry. Not least that part of Soviet industry occupied with arms manufacture. This was all admirably documented by Professor Anthony Sutton in his book, National Suicide. Sutton, probably the leading authority in the Western world on Western technological and industrial aid to the Soviet Union, showed in his book how most of the ships in the Soviet merchant marine were either built outside Russia or equipped with engines of foreign, in all cases Western, manufacture. In his words, about 100 Soviet ships are used on the Haiphong run in Vietnam to carry Soviet weapons and supplies for Hanoi's annual aggression. I was able to identify 84 of these ships. None of the main engines in these ships were designed and manufactured inside the USSR. All the larger and faster ships on the Haiphong run were built outside the USSR. All shipbuilding technology in the USSR comes directly or indirectly from the USA or its NATO allies. Sutton went on to describe the Gorky motor vehicle plant, until 1968 the largest in Russia. It produced, according to him, many of the trucks American pilots see on the Ho Chi Minh Trail, and military jeeps and rocket launchers besides. And the Gorky plant was built by the Ford Motor Company. Sutton also mentioned the well-known Fiat deal to build a plant on the Volga three times bigger than the Gorky one. But the Italian name and connections tended to hide the fact that over half the equipment came from the United States. The Soviets, continued Sutton, the book was written in the 1970s, are receiving now, today, equipment and technology for the largest heavy truck plant in the world, known as the Kamer plant. It will produce 100,000 10-ton trucks per year. That's more than all US manufacturers put together. Said Sutton, "We have built ourselves an enemy. We keep that self-declared enemy in business. This information has been blacked out by successive administrators." And, it might be added, blacked out here in Britain, in the press, by TV and radio, in the statements of our leading politicians on the alleged Cold War, JT writes. The question must be asked why. Why, if not to conceal the reality that, behind the appearance of conflict between the Soviet and Western worlds, there was all the time taking place an undercover collusion. On the Middle East, JT writes, common sense has always dictated that it is Britain's interest to maintain good relations with the Arab states. Yet, as in so many areas of policy, common sense has deserted us in the 20th century. We have alienated the Arab world and contributed to permanent instability in the Middle Eastern region by our support for the State of Israel. There was never a better opportunity to put a policy of close Anglo-Arab accord into operation than that at the time following World War I, when by cooperation between ourselves and Arab peoples, Turkish rule over large Arab areas of the Middle East had been removed. It will be recalled, in this connection, that T.E. Lawrence was able to enlist the help of considerable Arab guerrilla forces in the recent war against the Turks by carrying to them the promise of the British government of Arab freedom and sovereignty over the whole Arab area in the aftermath of victory. As history was recorded, this promise was cynically betrayed. At the very time that Lawrence, that's Lawrence of Arabia, was making it with perfect sincerity in his own case, his government was, behind the scenes, making a wholly contradictory promise to allocate Palestine to the Jews, which promise later became enshrined in the infamous Balfour Declaration. The most pressing purpose of this double cross, though there were certainly others, was to induce world Jewry to use its influence to bring the United States into the World War I. The very thinking behind this maneuver revealed the recognition, even at the early stage of the 20th century, of the enormous power of Jewry in America. This promise to the Jews was kept, of course, and the other one, to the Arabs, wasn't. The Middle East has been a troubled area ever since, JT points out, and Britain standing there has suffered grievously as a result of the loss of her reputation for keeping her word. Indeed, recent confrontations between the Western powers and Iraq owe much more to Jewish domination to neutralise the perceived threat to Israel than to any other factor. Everybody who is knowledgeable in Middle Eastern affairs is well aware that the existence of Israel is not in the slightest way based on a genuinely valid historical right, in quotes, of the Jews to that area, but rests solely on the fact of Zionist power, exercised over the governments of all the nations of the West, but particularly over that of the United States. At the end of the day, JT writes, we are forced to concede that our present position has to be the result of a continuous misdirection of policy. The misdirection has been largely in the field of domestic affairs, but the field of foreign affairs cannot be excluded from the indictment, the two fields of failure at root from an integral whole being simply common symptoms of bad leadership and a general national confusion as to what should be the aims and priorities of state. A disastrous domestic policy and a disastrous foreign policy are merely products of the same basic national rot. Cowardice, stupidity, lack of will, and almost total absence of true patriotic motive will all become reflected in one sphere just as in the other, adding to a basic unity. Our values, to condense it into a few words, have been false values, entirely out of harmony with the real forces that regulate the rhythm of the universe and determine the rise and fall and success and failure of nations and peoples. The restorations of sanity to our conduct of foreign relations will not come through some sudden revelation of truth to those responsible for that task, as long as the inner society of which they are a product remains unchanged. Sanity must come to reign within Britain itself, JT writes, permeating every nook and cranny of our public life and producing a new type of public servant, as remote from the present type as creatures from another planet. Then, and only then, will Britain's role in the big wide world outside have a direction and a purpose of the kind needed by a nation which wants to survive and prosper. Okay, that was the end of chapter 18, Britain and the World. The next one is called Scenario of War, but chapter 19 seems quite short, and it's then followed by the BMP. I may probably skip the BMP chapter, because it's very speculative about the party's future, written in 1998, and obviously we know that future now in 2014, so it's kind of not relevant, and also leaving one chapter out, you know, if people really want to read it, then they could always buy the book. So I think I'll skip that one. So the next episode should be the last of the John Tyndall series, as we can combine the last two chapters together. Okay. I'm going to play out with Richard Edmonds of the National Front speaking outside Croydon Crown Court in 2012. You've no doubt heard of Emma West. Well, eventually the charges was dropped and she had to apologise, etc., etc., right at the end. I mean, she stood her ground. I'm not quite proud of Emma West. She's really brave, I think. But at this time, when Richard Edmonds speaks, it was still not sure what would happen, and it looked quite likely that she might get jail just for speaking out against basically white genocide. So I'll play it with this video. It's only like 4 minutes long, but I must say, as I remember at the time, the National Front was the only party who openly spoke out in support of Emma West. So it's important, very important, I think. I hope I haven't played it before. I don't think I have. So I'll play it with that. Thanks for listening. Take care. 14 words.
This is the National Front reporting from Croydon Crown Court, South London. We can inform you that in the case against Emma West, the young mother charged with racially abusing passengers on a tram in South London, that this case has now been postponed to a later date. We would suggest that the British people take a serious interest in this and similar cases, because Emma West is facing potentially very serious consequences in this court, in this case. The consequences are that she is liable, in the worst case of all, to face imprisonment. The British people should ask themselves what is taking place in the inner areas of our great cities, where there has been so much immigration that the British people now themselves are becoming the minority. In the street and on public transport, a British person could find himself in a minority of one, surrounded by foreigners, all jabbering in their own tongues, and never to be heard a thank you or a by your leave. This is the daily reality faced and experienced by many people in our contemporary great cities. What should be of particular concern is how the judicial authorities deal with the almost inevitable breaches of the peace that can take place in these conditions of social alienation. Recently, a British woman travelling on the London Underground was condemned by the courts to 5 months in jail for the offence, in quotation marks, the offence in quotation marks, of stating that there is too much immigration into Britain. There was a time in a healthier Britain when a breach of the peace would lead to the magistrate issuing a reprimand and a bind over to keep the peace. Now we are seeing people being jailed in this country for the expression of their non-violent opinions. Today, our total sympathies are with Emma West, the young woman facing the dock and facing serious charges that are soon to take place here at Croydon Crown Court. This is the National Front, reporting from Croydon, South London.
Thanks for listening to Voice of Albion on the White Network.